Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome, UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Steve Hooper. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Adam. Always good to be here.
It's good to have you back. You know, on our show today, we have a really interesting guest, David Smith, computer scientist and CEO and founder of Croquet Studio, who's going to be talking about Windows and augmented reality and healthcare. I'm looking forward to that. First off, to find out what the heck he talks about, but also because I think we're on the cusp of changes that are going to occur across society, including healthcare, of incorporating better technology to better the lives of patients.
Absolutely. And I think there are things here that we probably can't even fathom yet in our imaginations, but you hope it leads to better healthcare, better access to care, and better quality of life for everyone.
And our children will know how to do it. Well, first off, we've got some research that matters. The very first one is something that will allow all of us to better understand the cost of drugs.
The cost of medicine is almost like buying your airline ticket. You never know what it's going to cost. It may change at different points in time, under different conditions. And in some instances, it might even be free if you get your frequent flyer miles. But long story short, we really don't have a good handle on what a medicine will cost us.
And this is actually new legislation that the Health and Human Services is requiring, that the drug companies will have to put the prices of their drugs per month for a usual course of therapy. Anything that's more than $35, which I guess is kind of like an average copay. So if it's more than that, they have to put it on there. And I think what's interesting is like the 10 most commonly advertised drugs have list prices from $488 to over $16,000 per month.
Staggering.
Staggering for usual course
staggering,
of therapy.
Staggering, yes.
And I think, you know, doctors a lot of times, you know, we're prescribing medicines. We don't necessarily know always, but we'll hear back all the time. Do you know how expensive that medicine was? It was $1,100 a month. I'm like, no, I didn't know that. Do you have insurance? Well, I have a high deductible, so I have to pay $1,100 a month.
Yes, the issue is in fairness in pricing and letting the consumer at some point make a decision about what they want to pay for this, taking into account that it is their health.
And they think that this could drive down the cost of the medicines. The drug companies say that this does not reflect what is usually paid by patient because it includes rebates and discounts drug makers may offer, but it is more transparency. That's a good thing.
Right. And we just hope that as the pharmaceutical industry has suggested that it does not discourage people from seeking health care.
Speaking of transparency, our next research that matters is directly relevant to what we're going to be talking about today. It's virtual reality and quality of life for people with dementia. And this is trying to really help people who have either Alzheimer's disease or other debilitating neurological diseases live better lives.
This is a fascinating application of virtual reality where they actually expose patients to potentially familiar areas or related areas in their lives that will stimulate old memories, which we know in many instances of dementia are the one lasting function that many individuals have.
So in this particular case, they had people kind of experience virtual environments of a cathedral, a forest, a sandy beach, a rocky beach, a countryside scene. And 16 different sessions were monitored with feedback from patients and caregivers to help these patients recall some old memory through new stimuli, and then try to see, did this actually stimulate new experiences with caregivers, with others, that they were to bring these stimuli back, but actually by remembering things from their past?
They actually found that in these 8 patients that they worked with, that the social interactions of the individual with dementia improved. And in addition to that, they suggested that positive changes in mood and motivation were apparent and across a number of activities.
Our next research that matters is about something near and dear to patients across North Carolina, probably most states in the country, which is the difference in dying from diabetes, diabetes mortality, in a urban area versus a rural area. It's not the same, apparently.
Exactly. And in fact, according to this study, in the last 20 years, the difference between those dying from diabetes in rural areas versus urban areas has significantly increased.
Yeah. So if you're living in a rural area, the diabetes mortality rate is substantially higher. We don't really know why that is. It could be lots of reasons. It could be access. It could be associated with poverty. It could be what we call the social determinants of health. But we do know it was not always this way. Less than a decade ago, it was really quite similar, and that yes. really has widened. It calls for some really, I think, serious soul searching for all of us to make sure that we give everyone the same quality of care and give everyone the same access to rights to basic care.
Absolutely. And I think going back to the last article, when we think about the use of virtual environments, virtual reality, or perhaps some of the things that our guest is going to talk about, there may be solutions there that would facilitate lessening this gap.
Our last research that matters is about broccoli and schizophrenia. Okay, I can't just leave it with that, can I? It's about actually chemicals in the brain and really some really cutting-edge science in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal Psychiatry, looking at, in people who have schizophrenia, this chemical glutamate and how you may have lower levels and maybe how to increase those levels and if increasing those levels could actually help treat and maybe prevent the need for other really potent, dangerous, sometimes medicines.
Right. It's the nouveau version of eat your vegetables in many ways. But I think one of the very interesting findings here is not only did it facilitate the positive aspects of the medication, it actually lessened the negative aspects of the medicine. So there's less tremors, less attention issues that are side effects to the medication that many individuals with schizophrenia need to take.
I would hope they would do the study also with broccoli. My wife would love that. You know, just eat more broccoli. I can see the commercials now. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with David Smith, computer scientist, CEO, and founder of Croquet Studio, about Windows and augmented reality and healthcare. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Steve Hooper. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. Today on Conversation, Steve, we're talking with David Smith, computer scientist, entrepreneur, CEO, and founder of Croquet Studio, about Windows and augmented reality and healthcare. Welcome to Your Health, David.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's not every day that we have entrepreneurs and people who are leading the charge in technology and virtual reality to talk about healthcare.
I might be the first.
You're right up there. But it's such an important, exciting conversation. Before we kind of get into why you're here, help us understand a little bit about your background. Maybe you always knew that you were destined for innovation.
That's possible. I certainly had the right education for it. I went to school at the University of Chicago years ago, and I had an undiagnosed case of ADD. And in those days, they didn't realize that that was a thing. And so I wound
Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder.
That's right.
Very common.
I wasn't hyperactive, but I certainly had the essential ADD. So what happened was I wound up majoring in 5 different things before I graduated. I actually did graduate. I'm very proud of that. But especially at University of Chicago, which is one of the more interesting places to go to, I wound up getting a very broad kind of education that other people didn't. I shifted around a bit, learned a lot, to the point, you know, in some cases I was literally sitting beside a Nobel Prize winner in one of the classes I took, one of the symposiums. You know, I touched on biology, mathematics, physics. That was actually, I didn't know at the time, it was like that was a frustrating experience. Oh, I'm not good at anything. Turned out I had learned a huge amount on all of those things, and it became very relevant. I got particularly interested in how the brain works at that time. I worked in a brain research lab to make money as a student. But when I graduated, I decided I didn't see the biological process working for me, because what we did was we were growing lamb brains in vitro. And I have to go into AI. So
artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence, exactly.
And at that time, AI was probably not even in our vocabulary.
Not in the general vocabulary. That's true. I mean, we're talking really 80, well, gosh, and I go back a bit, it's 83, 84 that happened. And I got extraordinarily lucky. I wound up working for a guy named Richard Greenblatt. Richard is, you've heard the term hacker, and of course we use that term as a guy who breaks things or steals things. But the original idea was somebody who understood systems and could build new systems. So when we think about all the things that we have around us today, those were built by the hackers that created a new reality that didn't exist before. Richard was interesting because, first of all, one of the things he did was wrote the first good chess program that could beat a human. The other thing he did was he created a new computer called a Lisp machine. Lisp is a language that's used for AI. And I fell head over heels with that. I learned an amazing amount from that experience. But oddly enough, it was the sociological part of hacking versus the actual computing part. I had a bed in my office. It was a cot, really.
And basically, bed in your office.
Yeah. So what? It was a weird time. So
you could have been a doctor, I think.
Yeah. Well, kind of. So you're programming at the computer, and basically you have to stop because you can't see the screen anymore. You get on the cot. 6 hours later, you wake up and pick up right where you left off. That was the kind of intensity. And it was sort of an apprenticeship for me.
When you use the term AI, or we've already said artificial intelligence, we also talk about augmented reality, virtual reality. Mm-hmm. Help us understand the difference between those types of terms.
There's virtual environment too, which is another term.
Oh, there's so many now. I think the one thing we have to look at is, one, AI is trying to imbue a computer with an ability to think in some form. It's not necessarily an intelligence as we think of it, but it's a way of sort of pattern matching, understanding to some degree, and being able to make a decision. And in those days, there was kind of this sort of the AIs that we'd explicitly program. Today, we have another thing we call machine learning, neural networks. That takes a very different approach, but it's sort of a pattern matching model. But they're basically, in a sense, and this is the link for me, was the computer is creating its own reality internally that's consistent and making decisions based upon that. And my link actually came a couple of ways. One is I saw the computer, first of all, as that ability to sort of understand and think. And the other way was it can express that information to a human in a really interesting way. So what I did was I wound up going into robotics. And one of the things I was really interested in is, how do I see what the robot's thinking? And so I developed some software that let me visualize what the robot saw of
the
world.
That question actually is just fascinating. Let me see what the robot is thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's creating an internal model just like we do, right? And it's going to use that model to, how it's going to engage with that world. At least in those days, that was reasonable. Today, it's much more difficult because the complexity of a neural net, we have no idea. It's a black box.
But aren't we, for instance, let's take, Steve, your field and rehabilitation, and we see with these spinal injuries, college student just the other day, jumping in the pool, spinal injury, and we're trying to teach these neural networks to reprogram, and we're doing these devices. Isn't that looking inside the robot to figure out how it's doing what it's doing?
Not really. You're seeing the pattern matching, the expression and end result of that, the nature of how those networks get formed, you really probably don't have much of a clue yet. You just know that they do, and then it's successful, it works. We also know that when certain parts of it break down, the system breaks down, and certain kinds of brain damage cause certain kinds of disabilities. We know that, but we don't necessarily know why. We don't know the nature of how those relationships between the systems internally cause that breakdown.
But if we did, or if we better understood the robots or the devices, would they be better? Could they be better?
It turns out, obviously, there's an interesting thing that happens. And it's like, yeah, we could maybe. But the reality is what happens is we get this interesting feedback loop where the systems start learning, which is really what the humans are doing. You know, when they're getting better at doing something, that's a very tight feedback loop. They're getting better. They see, oh, I did this a little bit, and it's all subconscious, right? And that had a positive response. If this is the way you learn how to walk, is the same thing, right? It's all about failure. You don't learn anything without failing. And so the system says, oh, he failed, and he was able to compensate, and next time he was able to go a little bit closer in the right direction. That's the nature of how neural networks work today. When we think about machine learning, what you're really looking at is systems, they don't automatically learn. What they do is they iterate millions of times, and they fail millions of times in the time we take a breath, and that's how they get better. And that's exactly how humans get better. That doesn't mean we understand it at all. No way can we take a scope and look into the human's structure and understand it. We might get a gross idea, but we won't get a really fine idea.
In some ways, that actually may be a precursor to what we may see as we move into the healthcare of the future in terms of being able to look at those algorithms and understand them better.
Perhaps. Actually, I think what's happening is going the other way. The systems are getting good at doing what you described at that pattern matching. We're not as good. So I just saw an article today where they're using AIs to do matching on lung cancer and actually determining whether that patient has cancer. And it turns out that they're actually about 11% better on average, these AIs, than a collection of 10 physicians. You can't really say, how does it know that? I mean, any more than you can say, well, how can you do organic chemistry where you can see those peaks and understand how it worked? I know I can do it. I can do it. I do that pattern matching. I can see that this is some sort of benzene. This is sort of, I see the mapping between the two. But we don't know how it works.
And I've seen that also in dermatology for skin cancer, mm-hmm. that the AI is actually better at diagnosing melanomas than the dermatologist. And at probably isn't totally surprising in many respects if you can break down the components into what leads to a diagnosis. But we're going to take a short break as we need to kind of get right back into here. But when we return, we're going to continue our conversation with David Smith, computer scientist, CEO, and founder of Croquet Studio, about Windows and augmented reality in healthcare. Stay with us. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with David Smith, computer scientist and CEO and founder of Croquet Studio, about Windows and augmented reality in healthcare. And I am just perplexed and excited about what this all is about. And I think one of the things that I learned initially was I have Dr. Greenblatt to thank for creating the program that I can always lose on chess when I'm traveling on a plane. But I think as we go forward, you know, I am real curious about how this technology and this perspective will impact healthcare in the future.
It's actually, it's such a big message, a big story. It's hard to say.
It's here now to some extent.
That's right. So one of the things that are simple, we're seeing from the AI side, an ability to diagnose in a way that we haven't seen before. The quality of diagnosis is extraordinarily good. I think one way to think about why these things get so good so quickly is where a human can only look at a few patients and sort of make assessments. These systems are being trained on all the data in the world. And so they've got millions of virtual patients that they've been able to look at and say, okay, not only do I know what this looks like, I know what the end result of that is. The VA has something like 5 million DNA records associated with their health records. Imagine what the value and meaning of that is. Imagine having an AI that can collate that information and be able to say, oh, you've got this DNA structure. We can feed that back into, you know, what we think is going to happen to you, very high probability. And so what you're seeing is on the machine learning side, some magical things. I'm particularly interested in what I call augmented reality, extended reality. It's sort of the thing where what that means to a lot of people is I get to see stuff that's out in the virtual world or out, you know, sort of a new object on this desktop that's only digital. I can manipulate it. Sort of like a Pokemon Go, you see the little characters through your phone, but you don't see them in real life. This is another kind of interaction, and I think of it as I call it an augmented conversation, where you and I are talking right now, and as I speak, we generate a simulation between us that all of us can interact with. It's live. Imagine it's, you know, we see a brain floating between us, and I'm going to take a slice out of it and say, hey, look at this, and you point to it, and you immediately understand. More than that, we can actually say, oh, let's see what happens over time. Let's age this and see how it evolves. So what we're really talking about, my particular interest is this augmented conversation, and it's augmented, first of all, the visual sense, but the other sense is the computer is a full participant in that conversation. It is not just me seeing something and interacting with it. The computer is literally saying, hey, let's do the simulation. Let's do something that a human could never do.
Let's give some examples. If we were talking about one of the major killers of people in the world, today, suicides. How does this technology, your vision of some of the ways that we might really attempt to deal with this through technology that we've not really thought about?
That's a really good question. And I think it has to do with, again, the sort of feedback loop that occurs. Yeah, you get into a position of being suicidal because all the factors kind of come together. You have this sort of sense of depression or whatever it is. But one of the things that we have an ability to do today is kind of engage with you. I think you're even beginning to see this kind of thing on Facebook where they're sensitive to certain keywords or sensitive to certain kinds of structure, you know, that sort of thing. So the one hand is we're evolving an ability to understand the symptoms. The other part is how do we feed that back in and use it to modify your behavior, modify the way you think. Now, this is a good and bad thing, by the way. I have a real concern if you look at the way Facebook works as an example. On the one hand, they're trying to figure out how you act, what you think, and they do that to figure out how to give you an ad that you might like. You know, it's like, do you like this? Do you like that? So that's actually kind of nice. But the other side is they're actually modifying your behavior. It's a feedback loop for them as well. So you have these two feedback loops, yours and its. And what it's trying to do is modify your behavior so that you like the stuff that you're giving them even more. Right? So they're sort of trying to control you. Now, that's sort of the dark side of this. And by the way, they're getting very good at it. The things that are most invisible are often the most powerful. But you could use that in a very virtuous way as well, where you are not just engaging and saying, oh, he's got a psychological problem, but we say, okay, we can do a feedback loop and actually maybe change that vector so that he's able to engage with the world, see the world from a slightly different perspective.
Which is what therapists do all the time, right? We're just talking about a different type of therapy or a different way of thinking about therapy.
That's right. The only difference, I think, this is the weird thing about augmented reality, and I think it's really central to what's about to happen, which is, you know, when you have your phone, it's sort of like a two-year-old, and what happens is it squawks and you need to give it attention and you're doing that, right? So it's a device in your pocket to access to all your friends, all your family. That's really cool. But it isn't you yet. There was an interesting thing Will Wright mentioned that you think of these things as these extensions. A good example is a car. When somebody hits your car, you never say, oh, I hit my car. Say, he hit me. We internalize these things, right? So what's happening here is, you know, the phone is this device that's almost us. We do say, you sent me an email, right, via the phone, but you called me. But that phone's becoming more and more personal. But what's going to happen as soon as it becomes a pair of glasses and the interface completely disappears, it's no longer in your pocket, it's always on. This feedback mechanism I was talking about with Facebook is also always on. You're constantly, the system, because you want
it's
it
learning.
To. It's learning.
It's a machine.
It's monitoring what you're doing. It's trying to enable and help you understand the world. But at the same time, it's creating a model of who you are. Any tool, and medium's a tool, changes you as much as you change it.
So if
right?
you're talking about things where positive feedback can be good or learned behavior could be beneficial, whether it's in mental illness or in acquiring new skill sets
or
in health.
Or even a chronic condition like coronary heart disease.
Right, and diet and other things. Those are all positive things. Is that a vision that you have for healthcare and the work that you're trying to create? Because you're trying to create this seamless way for anyone in the world to work collaboratively
yes.
to do these things.
Absolutely. The positives are absolutely there. I think that's really key thing. There's this feedback loop. It has to know about you. Your Apple Watch is monitoring your health today. That stuff's going to get better and better and better. That's so crucial. The system's going to be designed around taking care of you. But the other side of it is just as important, which is we're in this world where ideas are being passed back and forth and they're resonating. And what I mean by that, if I send you an idea and you're already thinking about that, then you're going to think about it more. And it doesn't matter if it's a good idea or if it's a bad idea, but we see these peakings of ideology, ideas, information, and we're seeing that much, much more today than ever because the resonance causes, you know, that person says, oh, I love that idea, I'm going to resend it to other people, or I'm allowed now to think that way and I'm going to resend it. And then we have this self-reinforcement network. Like I said, it doesn't matter if it's a good idea or a bad idea. So this is sort of a downside because there's no brakes on that. So for example, going back to earlier, somebody puts on Facebook, I'm thinking about suicide. People send messages, do it. This message that this person did, which was kind of a low amplitude message, I'm not feeling great, was just amplified by that person's network to cause them to actually go do that.
So or conversely, don't do it. Your life is meaningful.
Right.
We care about you.
And it all depends on how much the resonance is on either side.
In the machine, will it make a judgment about good or bad?
That
or
may
will
be
it?
The saving grace here yeah. is that to this point, we've let it go unchecked. There's no dampers to the resonance, right? We just let it go. And that's incredibly nice when somebody agrees with you, right? But the trick is now that we found that it not only does it reinforce these wonderful good things, it's totally agnostic about the value of the information. It reinforces the bad things, the things that we consider to be detrimental to society.
What is Croquet? Because this is where you're spending your time now, and it underlies the ability to do everything we're talking about.
Yeah, Croquet is a collaboration system. What you see and what I see is running identical. It's a bit identical simulation. And if I modify that simulation, you see that modification, that simulation in real time. And so we utilize that simulation as a way of expanding the scope of our conversation. I call it augmented conversation, this idea that we're now being able to expand the nature of how we think via the nature of how we communicate.
And could this be used within the physician-patient relationship?
Oh, absolutely.
Give us one example.
You're going to walk in to see a patient, and you're going to see every bit of information about him. And not only that, but you're going to be able to use that to engage with him to show him, hey, I saw this. The conversation is going to have a much more bandwidth and much more structure. So that engagement is going to be much more valuable. You're going to already see everything that the systems have developed for you, but then you can focus on the things that matter in that instant because it's going to be highlighted. And you and the patient are going to have a conversation that's a lot more meaningful, to the point. But also, this is the real key thing. It's going to let you communicate things that have been, to this point, way too complex to communicate before. And so it's going to allow you to tell the story that you need to tell.
And you're going to be able to do that in real time.
Yep.
And you're going to be able to possibly do that in the patient's setting and not necessarily mm-hmm. in a health provider's office.
Anywhere, anytime. You guys both wear glasses. That's what it's going to be. Everybody, today you put your glasses on to be able to see the world. If you didn't have it, you couldn't drive maybe. Well, what happens is you're going to put these glasses on in the morning just like you do now, but it allows you to see the digital world that is invisible to you. If I turn the lights off in the room we're in right now, you could still get around, but it'd be difficult, right? The digital world is just as real as this physical world. You're just blind to it. You don't have the right glasses yet. We haven't turned that light bulb on. So what's going to happen is you're going to put those glasses on in the morning. You don't put them on before you see the patient. You've had them all day long. In fact, you've got information before you even got to the patient about what to expect, what to understand. You had an ability to immediately pull that in. You can do that now with your pad, your tablets, right? But in this case, it's just going to be a very natural thing, just like you're looking at a piece of paper with your glasses. That information is carried with you. And every person you meet, you have an ability to have this augmented conversation, and they don't even have to be physically present. You can have that conversation with somebody who's on the other side of the world if you need to.
And will you be able to shut off the conversation?
Well, that's a good question, because what we're seeing is it going the other way. A good example is every light bulb is going to have a computer in it. And for that matter, it's very likely they'll have cameras and projectors. There's going to be a cloud of sensors throughout the world. And so you might be able to take your glasses off and say, oh, I don't want to deal with it, but it doesn't go away. I don't know what the answer is. We sort of like, I'll pose it a different way. Give me your phone for a week. Can you do that? Can you give me your phone for a week and be able to survive in a way that makes you part of society and successfully do the things you do today?
Yeah, we probably could, but most people wouldn't.
I think you couldn't, actually.
It would be a challenge.
I believe it would. And it's sort of like there's this like desert island survival model where you're the only guy on that desert island. You can survive that, but you can't do it for long. Not if you're actively engaged with the world today. And what I'm talking about is something that's 1,000 times more integrated into who you are. Like I said, a car, when somebody hits you, they hit my car. When you wear these devices, it is you. We've just turned you inside out. The internet is, you now.
I think this conversation is emblematic of the challenge, which is it's an unlimited conversation because we can mm-hmm. keep going because the needs and the questions are far more than the answers are sufficient. And I think you've helped us today understand some of the questions, some of the challenges, some of the opportunities. And I think for all those things, on behalf of your health, I think we really need to thank you. We've been talking with David Smith about windows and augmented reality in healthcare. Thank you for being our guest today.
A real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Amazing. Amazing.
Thanks.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be able to take our glasses off. But when we return, we'll be able to continue our house calls. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Stephen Hooper. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segments of our show today, Steve and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first house call question. Laura?
I'm 35, and I was recently diagnosed with guttate psoriasis. No one can tell me why it came on, but I itch all over my entire body. Who's the quarterback in this situation? My primary care doctor, my dermatologist, a rheumatologist, or even a psychiatrist?
The analogy is a good one. I'm not sure who the quarterback is right now, but I can tell you it takes a team.
Adam, you think you start with your primary care provider.
You do. But I will say also that primary care physicians certainly have heard of and may have seen a case or two of some of guttate psoriasis. This is a psoriasis that looks like almost teardrops that are kind of like almost spray painted, little dots all over the body, tear shaped, but they're incredibly itchy, like all psoriasis. And it can mimic lots of things. It may need a biopsy. And so frequently those patients do end up with dermatologists. And a lot of the drugs that are needed, the diagnosis is relatively straightforward, but the treatment is more complicated. It oftentimes requires multiple topical medications and sometimes oral medications, including sometimes what we call these biologics, those newer class of medicines that are much more potent, and most primary care doctors don't have as much experience using them. So the quarterback could be the dermatologist. Wide receiver could be the primary care physician. The running back could be a rheumatologist because they may have pain in their joints. They may have the psoriatic arthritis, may need to kind of see if there's other things going on. And then you know what? Probably a good center could be a psychiatrist because we all need a centering person in our lives, particularly in the face of a chronic illness that could be kind of and the itching itself is so debilitating.
And the individual should not be surprised then that they have multiple players on that team.
Right. And it's most important that those providers actually communicate with one another. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My mother had a stroke 6 years ago that left her with aphasia. She had speech therapy at the time, and it got a little better. Now, 4 years later, she'd like to see a speech therapist again to see if she can get some more improvement. Is this reasonable, do you think?
Well, Adam, I would have to say yes, it is, in large part because, as the old adage goes, practice makes perfect. And if someone has had an injury that created speech issues, then indeed there was the initial recovery that's occurred and the rehabilitation that may have occurred during that time frame. But there's always potential room for improvement with practice, especially guided practice from a speech and language expert.
And there may well be new advances in the way we understand, new treatments. They may have forgotten. Their caregiver might want to have some education. It might be a new caregiver, right? I would imagine not all caregivers know exactly how to respond when someone has aphasia and is struggling to say something. Do you say the word for them, or do you give them, you know, do they spell it out? What are the tools to help someone live a better life?
I think a major factor in this listener's question is the mother is motivated. The mother is motivated to get into treatment and learn more and practice more, and I think it warrants pursuit of honoring that request.
In line of all the things that we can do in medicine, it's probably pretty darn cost-effective.
Yeah.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
My doctor told me that because of my diabetes and my high blood pressure, that I also needed to take a statin. I was wondering if I could take it for a year and then stop, or is there any other way to avoid adding a statin?
Well, you could take it for a year and then stop, but that's not what doctors are going to recommend. You can take it for a week and then stop it, but that's not what I would recommend.
Aren't there guidelines, Adam?
Yeah, there are guidelines, and it really has to do with the fact if you've got diabetes and certainly high blood pressure, you're at such great risk for coronary artery disease, heart disease, that they recommend that you take a statin to lower that risk. And it is a lifelong, and it doesn't even really depend on what your cholesterol is to start with. But there is another option. You could maybe lose enough weight so that your insulin of your own body takes back over and you actually don't have to be on diabetes medications and maybe you're no longer diabetic. Then there's a little bit of controversy about whether or not you'd have to be on a statin. Yes. You probably would lose enough weight that your blood pressure would be okay. Well, we want to thank you all for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can share your own story by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, David Smith, and I want to thank our guest co-host today, Dr. Steve Hooper. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Stephen Hooper.
Look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.